Welcome to the special edition of the Uptime Wind Energy Podcast. I'm your host, Alan Hall, and I'm here with my co-host, Joel Sexsom. Our guest today is Jatin Sharma, Managing Partner at Nardac. Nardac is an independent wholesale broker which navigates the relationship between insurance carriers and retail brokers. And as the turbulent as the insurance market is at the moment, Nardac may be your key to success weathering the insurance storm. Nardac is a specialist for large, complex projects, and that includes a focus on renewable energy. Whether you're an original equipment manufacturer, a developer building a wind farm, or an asset owner, Nardac helps the industry understand the risks. Jatin, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So Alan and I, of course, in the lightning world and wind, and with the podcast and the networks that we have, we talk to people about failures and fires and gearboxes and all these different things. Do you see the macro changes, right? So I say this because I've talked with people in the insurance world or on the risk world on the IPP side that say, yeah, our premium is going up on this site, or our deductibles are starting to increase here for this reason. And to me, it seems like that's more of a, you know, like a micro, like, okay, that's specific to this project, this technology, this site. Mostly it's this site. But with better communication strategies and a more integrated insurance market, do you see the premiums or the deductibles starting to change? And let's for ease of use, let's focus on like the U.S. onshore market, say.
If we did like a 3 to 5 year time horizon with today versus, you know, 3 to 5 years ago, I'd say that we've probably seen an increase of about 40% on the price paid per megawatt for wind operators in the U.S. And that would be my kind of average number, you know, across a portfolio. And that's on a risk-adjusted basis. And you might say, wow, 40%, that's a lot. That's pretty material. What does that do to your OPEX? What does that do to valuations? I think it's important to put it in context that insurance is directly linked to the cost of capital. So in the same way that, you know, 5 years ago, if you told me you had $1 million and you're going to put it in the bank account, you're probably going to get 0.25% interest, maybe 0.5%, you know, on the lowest risk opportunity. Now you go and put it in, maybe you can get 5.5%. In the same way, insurers will have turned around and said, well, if 5 years ago, you know, for every $100 you were giving me and I was giving you back $55 to $65 in claims, you know, payments, let's say loose numbers here, you know, that is no longer an acceptable return. You know, I want to be giving you, you know, I want to be getting $150 and I want to, you know, not give back more than $50 to $75, you know, in that sort of ratio. And it's the law of large numbers. So there are many sites that have zero claims, and every now and again you have a catastrophic fire, and that one fire is enough to wipe out the entire premium base of Vermont wind farms. You know, so just, you know, there is that kind of proportionality behind it.
Well, there has been some of those large, I mean, on the solar side too, that one in Texas, $100 million losses and stuff. And those things, in my mind, like, case of course, I'm not an insurance professional, but have to kind of shake the foundation of what that insurance looks like as well. Because then, I mean, natural catastrophes in the United States, we don't see this as much or understand this in a general sense as a U.S. citizen, because we grow up seeing tornadoes and floods and fires and stuff on the news all the time. But to be honest with you, the extreme weather in like the central part of the United States, whether it's hail, lightning, tornadoes, these kind of things, it's not as common in the rest of the world. So natural catastrophe is a little bit more extreme here sometimes.
I would argue that the wind side is more robust in terms of technology and how it's fared. And so the wind industry needs to be treated differently from other technologies that are potentially more susceptible based on how the technology has been built. So we do tend to push back a little bit when insurers try to tar wind with the same brush as solar and other technologies. But yeah, look, fundamentally, this is first world country, third world weather, you know, somebody once said to me. And the challenge is that if you look at kind of the trifecta of how developers want to use their investment dollars, they want the best power purchase agreement per megawatt hour that they can get. They want the best P90 value that they can get, so great resource, and they want to spend the lowest cost per megawatt, you know. So that's your trifecta. Well, by that token, it's great to get into the Japanese market, or it's great to get into, you know, the Puerto Rico market for solar. And if you look at the US, well, yeah, okay, I could probably get into Texas and build new wind farms. My cost per megawatt is going to be very competitive. I can build it cheaply. The resource is pretty good for the most part with wind speed studies, but you know, my PPA is not going to be great compared to others. Maybe I can get a hedge. Maybe I can get some corporate PPA money. And so they'll look at it that way. And I think the economics of renewables and the sites that have had bigger claims, you know, you get what you pay for. Like if you buy land that's very cheap and are able to build a very large project, you know, there's a reason why you couldn't do that in PJM. There's a reason you couldn't do that in, you know, parts of Utah. And some of the areas that are fairly benign, there's plenty of space to build those projects, but is there enough demand at the node, you know, in that particular location for a big mega project? And is there going to be enough return on investment? So those are some of the factors that come into play.
That's an interesting concept to me as well, because now we're looking at offshore wind in the U.S. And offshore wind in the U.S., I would imagine that the models that are based on things to happen aren't as developed, because there hasn't really been, say, East Coast U.S., there hasn't been an actual, you know, a civil development offshore. So are those things, is that uncharted waters, or do you guys have a pretty good handle on what's going to happen out there for natural catastrophes?
I remember being at an offshore wind conference in Tysons Corner, maybe back in 2010, and it was full of a bunch of CEOs, and I had to give a small presentation about kind of why European windstorm risk versus US hurricane risk, you know, the two do not necessarily compute with the added exposure that you're getting here. And many of these developers were looking at that kind of Boswash location, so Boston to Washington, you know, in terms of development. And one of them said to me, oh, you just don't know what you're talking about. Hurricanes don't go up that far. They don't do this. Superstorm Sandy was probably the next year, or...
Yeah, the Jerseys, yeah, yeah, just beat the hell out of it, yeah.
So I think to some extent, offshore wind has been pretty robust against major European windstorms, and there are some studies by third-party consulting companies that have kind of shown that. But it doesn't mean that they've necessarily been tested in the same way to a category, you know, 2, 3 or higher, from Virginia up to Maine. And, you know, the insurance industry gives a level of coverage for those projects. But as soon as you have one big loss, you know, the amount of coverage available for it becomes very limited. It's not dissimilar to, you know, the hail example you gave. Suddenly the market learns of a large loss in the ERCOT ISO, and suddenly, you know, it's no longer available on a commercial basis to get full value hail. So I think we're kind of playing this kind of game of chicken with natural catastrophe impacting a project.
Yeah, a couple local codes, regulations, and even at the state level, there seems to be a lot of changes happening, where some states just essentially outlawing renewable projects altogether. You've had the problems on the East Coast for offshore wind with the state of New Jersey and the state of New York and some of the permitting. How does that play into the insurance market? How do they address those risks? And what are they looking forward? What are some of the likely things to happen in the next couple of years there?
I should probably say that insurance is really there to cover the project against sudden and unforeseen risk, so fortuitous risk. Typically, it doesn't look at enterprise risk, you know, so a developer failing to get a project to go ahead because of a, you know, part of the stakeholders at government level basically saying you can't build. You know, if a claim is exacerbated by government ordinance, yeah, insurance will come in to kind of do that, but the project should already be in construction, or it should be operating. We've typically seen claims inflation happen when there's been, like, for example, an offshore wind. Let's say something goes wrong on the project, vessels need to come in, intervene to repair something, but there are environmental restrictions around. You can't do any construction during this period because it's sensitive to, you know, local duck mating season or whatever it might be. Like, we do see that, but yeah, insurance is really there to say, hey, who's taking investment risk on this project that's ready to, you know, it's shovel ready? Who's taking investment risk on this project that's now operating? you know, what sort of things keep you up at night? Oh, if the transformer blows up, if we lose a number of turbines from a natural catastrophe, if the battery storage unit goes out, like those are the things that insurance is really there to get involved in.
To sister onto that, does it affect the capacity coming from the global markets, right? So like the capacity that you guys get to deploy coming from Zurich and coming from, you know, different places in the world, are those companies watching what's happening politically elsewhere and saying, you know what, we were gonna, you know, put $400 million into the pool to give into this and write some percentages on it, but, you know, now we're just going to kind of turn ourselves elsewhere? Or is that capital still there and available in lieu of these permitting issues?
Insurers love a good silo. And, you know, offshore, onshore are distinct silos. And they carry different term horizons as well. So if you look at an offshore wind project, you know, realizing the construction to COD of one of those could be a 3 to 5 year period, depending on its size. That will be one particular division that would probably look at that sort of, you know, what's my cost of capital? What's the term? Where is it going to be based? How much exposure am I going to take? I think where it's been problematic is a number of developers recently, you know, giving signals that they're pulling back in deploying, you know, CapEx for certain projects. Meanwhile, the insurers have said, well, we just spent all this money pulling out of oil and gas to now retrain some of our staff to focus on offshore wind. What are they meant to do? You know, is there a role for them? And then kind of reshuffling them internally. And we have seen that some companies have kind of been ahead of the project life cycle and ahead of the potential growth, only to find that there's nothing for those people to do, you know, because the projects haven't materialized. And, you know, US offshore, you know, it's one of those things that's kind of dragged out for many years. You know, we've seen this kind of stop start from demonstration phase to now some utility projects potentially materializing. But it's been unfortunately, it's been a bit of a stop start.
Is the insurance market going to get involved heavily in the battery long-term storage market? It seems like even in ERCOT, there's going to be a big shift there to install a lot of batteries over the next year. Is that market coming together?
Yeah. So when we first launched the business in 2020, I thought we would be doing offshore wind all day, every day. And actually, you know, 1 in 5 deals we've done have been batteries, whether it's been microgrids in, you know, PJM, New York, areas with more densely urbanized areas, to large scale BESS projects in the middle of nowhere, you know, between Arizona and California, parts of ERCOT, with utility scale batteries. And so the insurance market has been fairly lukewarm on batteries because some of them have been on the more prominent claims. You know, it's hard for the actuaries to get their head around, well, what's the loss projection on a new technology? What's my, you know, 20-year claims history for this class of business? You know, how is it protected? And you know, it's its own technology, it's its own occupancy. Technology becomes obsolete very quickly. So all of these questions led to kind of limited underwriting appetite. And we spent the best part of 3.5 years gradually educating, persuading underwriting capital, whether it was in the US or London, to really get involved in this space. And we have our own product coming out in the end of April, called Flex, which if you're a battery geek, you know why we called it that. But it's really designed to provide dedicated capacity for many of these battery companies through their retail brokers, with some specialist knowledge that can actually support them on battery deals, whether it's microgrid or utility scale. So again, that's one of the beauties of being a boutique. You can identify and say, here's clearly a gap of knowledge in the market, you know, that we've understood based on a number of transactions and experience. How do we find a more efficient solution for our clients to access that capital in a way that adds value for the end transaction? And, you know, we're seeing so much growth, which is fantastic because the grid side is really slow to move. So to have battery deployment, you know, if it's done in a sustainable way, I think is really positive.
So Jatin, we've touched on a lot of topics here, and appreciate the fact that you're so sharp on all of them and kind of just rattle off answers to our questions, which is great. But one of the things that we're seeing, again, I'm talking from the Lightning space, right? So there we've had in the United States, 2009 to 2012, there was GE 1.5s were the flavor of the day, and they got installed everywhere, right? There's tons of them. Well, those turbines are, you know, 37 to 40 meter blades and 80 meter tower height. So mostly, so you're, you know, 120 meters ish height. But now we're getting to these 3, 4, 5 megawatts, like the Vestas V150s and the SGRE platforms, and they're reaching really high. And we're starting to see a lot more lightning damage to some of these. And it's based on, you know, some of it's just based on physics, right? Your cloud base is lower, you're up closer to them, things happen. But what does these bigger machines look like for the risk appetite on your side?
Insurers are usually quite nervous about underwriting innovation, even if it's not a revolution, but it's an evolution. So increasing a blade length, well, we don't actually know what the impact of that blade length increase is going to have on the gearbox performance. And in some of the early models that, you know, I've been involved in, where they did jump up to a 3.5 megawatt unit on a certain OEM platform, suddenly there's a bunch of mechanical electrical breakdown claims, you know, resulting from enhanced torque effect inside the nacelle. So, you know, again, we've got PhDs and claims professionals on my team, and they can speak at much greater length to this. But, you know, underwriters will be cautious that whilst the developer may get a bigger windswept area and ultimately, you know, pi r squared, they can get more return on their investment, they'll be looking at it and saying, well, I've got newer technology risk. I've got something that when it goes wrong, I don't have a lot of, have a high lead replacement time. It's not like these blades are just manufactured in the same level as for a 90 meter rotor with 45 meter blades. Like there's going to be an element of longer lead replacement times. The cost of that with any available crane that can handle that sort of height is going to be much longer. So potentially a higher downtime. And because the expected revenue is such a higher windswept area is greater, then that's an even more enhanced downtime. So I think the smaller, older units have actually been pretty good performers for a lot of our companies. We're seeing a number of clients now enter the repower space, choosing to just kind of leave things as they are and make small tweaks and then get into the 80-20 PTC kind of repowering campaign. But the larger units, you know, there is a certain amount of trepidation from insurers. And again, you know, with the value of the turbine now being 3 to 4 times higher than the original 1.5s to 2s that we're talking about, you know, they've said, well, our deductible should go up in proportion to that. You know, we're not going to give $100,000 deductible like we did on those units. You know, we want to be looking at $250,000 to $500,000. And it's like, well, okay, the margin for error then is pretty small for the developers who are taking that on their balance sheet.
Yeah, that all makes sense. We always go by the simple rule of $1 million a megawatt, right? So if you had a GE 1.5 and that whole turbine came down, generally 1.5 at the cost, right? That's not cranes and all this other stuff. But now if you had the same kind, it can be the same event, right? It can be a blade failure caused by XYZ, you name it. A blade failure swings down, hits the tower, takes the turbine down. Now, if you have that same exact thing happen on a 4 or 5 megawatt platform, that turbine is not $1.5 million. It's $5 million. So the risk is in proportion.
Well, and that's based on economies of scale too, because most people will sign a turbine supply agreement, and let's say they do a 300 megawatt project and the turbine supply agreement averages out to 1.2 million per megawatt roughly on a new project. But if you have a single turbine loss, I'm sure it's going to cost more like $2.5 million per megawatt to replace it, just based on, you know, the cost of procuring a single turbine versus the cost of procuring, you know, the 100 that you did for the site, and the lack of economies of scale. Plus, you know, unless you're a developer that's ordering 20 more of these for 20 more projects, it's hard to get to the top of the order book with some of the OEMs, because they're signing up to 3 or 4 large customers. And that's what's really driving it. So yeah, force majeure events like that do happen, and replacing those units is very time consuming.
Does the SunZia projects and things of that scale with new turbines, new place, massive areas, new transmission lines, does that throw some unknowns into the otherwise relatively simple calculations on what rates should be and how an insurance should approach it?
Coverage, pricing, you know, for the technical space like operational wind or construction of these projects, you know, it's no different from you sitting down and, you know, negotiating your life insurance with a carrier. They'll ask you, you know, what's your age? Do you smoke? You know, what's your diet? Like, there's all these kind of basic things. And in the same way, if you're doing a 600 megawatt project or 1,000 megawatt project, you know, where is it? First thing we're going to do is look at the natural catastrophe exposure. And there's a huge difference between being in Brazoria County versus being in, you know, Nevada. You know, the amount of aggregate exposure the insurers have for some of these projects in the middle of nowhere is very different to if you're doing a project, you know, close to a large baseload center, you know, near a major metropolitan area where insurers already got a lot of aggregate exposure. Then it comes down to, well, who's your contractor? You know, if it's construction, there's going to be all these kind of qualitative questions about who's the EPC, who's doing the project management coordination, who are the suppliers, what do we know about their failure rates? When it goes operational, is there one transformer, are there multiple transformers? How much redundancy is there? And then you know, once you go through those, I don't know, 26 independent variables, you ultimately come up with a price, which on a benchmarking basis, you know, if you're facetious, you can say, well, I could have reverse engineered that number and it's within, you know, $4,000 per megawatt, you know, or whatever it might be. But I think there is a kind of science behind it. And many people who've done this job and have done it profitably for their carriers, you know, they're quite high in demand right now because many people try and get into renewable energy insurance, but not many people have done it for long enough where they can actually say, I had a profitable book of business and this is how I did it. And many of those people have had to adapt to equipment going from onshore to offshore or from fixed bottom to floating or from solar PV on the West Coast and East Coast moving into the inland of the country. So there is a science behind it. And I think, you know, those quantitative and qualitative variables are ultimately what helps you drive the price and coverage on those sort of deals.
A lot of the, or the majority of the carriers, the underwriters, the capacity coming in, and even the brokers, they don't have subject matter experts on board. They may have a couple of risk engineers that are there, but much like a lot of other engineers in the renewable energy space, they're being tasked with stuff that it's too much, right? You have, I know of companies that, you know, they're writing policies left and right. However, they only have like one risk engineer and they're responsible for battery storage and solar and wind and all these different things. And so to me, that's a big problem in the industry because the majority of things that are happening on the financial level and not necessarily on the engineering level. There are a few companies that do the engineering side of things great, FM Global being one of them, right? They put out their little sheets and all these different things. They have a lot of insights. So that's one of the differences that I see of you guys at NARDAC right now, having this conversation with you. I've talked with Robert Bates and I've talked with Dr. Tom before and gleaned some things from them. Smart people on your team. And I think that's what sets you guys apart in the industry.
I think we try and start with the end in mind, you know, so when we come in, I described it as kind of a relief pitcher. You know, many of the retail broker clients that we work with that are supporting developers, IPPs, utilities, you know, they have their own in-house experts and we try not to take anything away from that. We try and build on it and enhance it with access to alternative capital providers that may, you know, want to support those projects because that's part of their growth focus. Everything's become so commoditized that actually one of the reasons I enjoy working in the insurance industry, I'm one of the few people that went from school straight to insurance after finishing my undergrad degree and then kept working in insurance during grad school and business school, you know, is that it's a relationship business built on kind of expertise, negotiation, persuasion, and trust. And so, you know, if you send out your IPP's portfolio to 50 insurers and just think, well, you're going to get the optimum result, you're actually just going to waste, you know, 46 insurers' times. It's a much more slow burn and it involves inviting people to your site. It involves meeting the head of O&M. And the developers that do this well, you know, sometimes they'll have a professional buyer of insurance in-house. And other times it'll just be the CFO, general counsel, or head of asset management that is just a much more informed buyer. And so they bring insurers along in the process. And it's kind of marrying up the specialist expertise that they have in-house with getting in front of insurers, creating a relationship where there's buy-in to what they're doing and why they're doing it. So then when they do go and buy a 5-megawatt platform, or they do decide to do a Frankenstein repowering campaign, you know, whatever it might be, there is buy-in into what they're doing. And it's meant in an authentic, genuine way. If the wind developers listening to this aren't all in Disneyland with us during RE Plus in September, they're doing something wrong, you know, because that's where you need to be building your relationship and ultimately getting buy-in for what the company's doing.
Well, Jatin, if people want to go visit Disneyland this fall and meet with you, how do they do it? How do they connect with you?
Yeah, look, we're on nardac.com has all the contact information of the different partners. You can email us. We have a LinkedIn page. You can message us on LinkedIn as well. Don't be shy. If we can support you and your retail insurance broker on any transactions, we'd love to help.
If you're an operator, owner, or developer out there looking for help in the insurance marketplace, Nardac is the place to reach out to. So, Jatin, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you.